Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
Good evening. My name is Misha Stone, and I work in the Reader Services Department upstairs here at the Central Library, and I want to thank you for coming out tonight. We are excited to be hosting this event tonight with Gay City to highlight World AIDS Day in a conversation with Phil Wilson, the CEO and founder of Black AIDS Institute. Now I'm going to pass the evening over for an introduction by Fred Swanson from Gay City.
Thank you so much. I'm so enamored with the door. I was like so amazed. Reminded me, my dad was in the Navy, of like those aircraft carrier doors. Anyway, I want to thank the Seattle Public Library. They have been an incredible partner to Gay City. For those of you who don't know, we have an LGBT library. We have 8,000 volumes of LGBT literature, fiction, nonfiction, a lending library up on Capitol Hill. So please stop by. We have a Meet the Author series and have done quite a few events with the Seattle Public Library, and they've been incredibly supportive. So thank you so much for that and for this tonight. It's been a long day for Phil Wilson. He started this morning at our World AIDS Day breakfast, which was a phenomenal event, and thank you so much. And I know it's been a long day for me, too, so I'm getting a little tired. But probably not as tired as you, because you've been speaking all day. I've known Phil for several years. I know the first couple times I met him, I was, like, totally intimidated. And I wouldn't, like, look at him in the eyes, because I was like, I don't know, I don't want to have to talk. But what I discovered, of course, as I got to know him and hear his stories, is that he's an incredibly generous man and a kind soul. And he knows so much about so many things, about LGBT history, about Black African-American history, about the history of AIDS, about injustice. He's just an incredible man. And I should say, as a person who is raising mixed-race kids, he knows a lot about parenting. And those stories, I think in particular, have really touched me and have brought so much to my family. So thank you for that as well. He's not only the CEO and founder of Black AIDS Institute. We went through a whole list of organizations that he either founded or helped nurture over the years, and just an incredible, incredible person. So we're so thrilled to have you here. Thank you so much. Talking and leading the conversation tonight is Brady Walkinshaw, our state representative from the 43rd. Thank you, Brady. For those of you who don't know about Gay City, we've been around since 95, actually kind of since 93, but officially since 95. We are an LGBTQ organization. We work in four areas: health, resources, arts, community. So our health work, our HIV work, we're the leading testing provider in King County, free testing. We have two sites where we do testing 6 days a week in English and Spanish, and then we do testing all throughout as well. We also, on Tuesday nights, have a community PrEP clinic, and so access to pre-exposure prophylaxis. And with that clinic, we particularly try to serve people who don't have insurance or who don't have other means of accessing PrEP. And we try to get them started on PrEP, get them hooked up with insurance, and then within 6 months, move them to a primary care provider who can not only help them with the PrEP, but everything else as well. Anyway, so I want to turn it over to Brady and Phil.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Fred. I should just start by giving an incredible thanks to Gay City. It was a wonderful World AIDS Day breakfast this morning, and someone here in the audience was actually recognized with an achievement award. We have George Bacon here, who was recognized with an achievement award from World AIDS Day breakfast this morning. He's with Seattle Gay News. So it's great to have you all here with us. This is exciting. It's great to welcome Phil to Seattle. And I wanted to kick off with one question that is sort of about generational change. And this last year in Seattle, we re-premiered a staging of Angels in America. And you know, that was staged here for the first time in 1994. You know, Tony Award-winning Tony Kushner came, and And I remember that growing up. And we did that again last year. And, you know, lots of audiences, lots of conversation kind of 20 years later from 1994 to 2014. And one of my, you know, as a father and as someone who's followed this for so many years and been a leader, what do you impart to your kids? How do you kind of share history? And how do you think about telling history of the last 20, 30, 40 years?
Wow.
to start with an easy question.
Question. Well, no, both of my kids are now adults. You know, one is 35 and one is 32. And so I'm in a different position than people are who have children. Now, I think that a lot of our life, you know, was really living in the middle of the worst part of the AIDS epidemic. And so that story was about what were we experiencing and then connecting that to things that had happened before. Now, and I think that you know, as a way to tell the AIDS story now that we're on a different side of it, you know, really is tied to talking about what's happening now. Now, so for example, I was in Paris two Fridays ago when the attack happened in Paris. You know, we are now having conversations around the Syrian refugees. You know, there are all these things that are happening in the world in real time, and using those as opportunities to connect the dots. Because in many ways, you know, there's this saying that everything that is worth saying has already been said, but since apparently no one was listening, it's worth saying again. So the dots are always there to connect.
And what, you know, when you think about, you know, people coming of age today, LGBTQ questioning, you know, wherever someone may be on the gender spectrum, how do you... You know, what are some of your hopes that young people kind of remember and take as lessons?
The biggest thing is that they're okay. Now, the biggest thing, you know, I think that the most important gift that you can give to a young person is that you are okay. Because there's so many places over the course of a young person's life where you either get or you create a different message. You know, and I think that, you know, being raised by... You know, in a family where my parents were not wealthy, you know, the one thing that they gave us that I am so grateful for and has been more valuable than anything else that they could have ever given me was the notion that I was okay. You know, and you begin there and there's no limits.
You know, I was thinking as I was coming here, was thinking after your talk as well, and there was conversations about vaccines and technology this morning at the World AIDS Day breakfast. And we have a lot of organizations here in Seattle doing a lot of research, Fred Hutchinson Center for Research on Cancer. We have many, many partners doing a lot of work, cutting-edge research. How do you think about technology today and HIV?
I worry about whether or not it's making us better. That's probably my overwhelming thought about technology. Is it actually making us better? And how accessible is it? You know, and it also comes back to the kind of connecting the dots. Earlier today, I talked about biomedical interventions and how remarkable, you know, the new scientific advances have been to changing the trajectory of the HIV epidemic. And the story that I told was about my personal experience that I am on ARVs. You know, I am a person who represents the power of the breakthroughs around protease inhibitors. In 1996, literally, my doctors called my mother, who lives in Chicago, and I live in Los Angeles, and they said to my mother that if you want to see him alive, you need to come to Los Angeles now. And my mother said, what was the prognosis? And the doctor said, well, if you leave your house, immediately go to O'Hare, and you're lucky enough to get on a plane, he might still be alive when you land in Los Angeles 4 hours later, but we don't promise you. And here I am today because of those technologies. But yet every night when I get ready to go to bed, the last thing I do is I take my medicine and I look at these three pills in my hand, and the one thing that I observe every single night, that not a single one of those pills has the ability to get into my body without my assistance. What the pills do is technology. No, it's biomedical. What I do is behavior. And whether we're talking about biomedical technology or whether we're talking about communications technology or whether we're talking about transportation technology is the marriage between technology and behavior that moves us forward, and we should never forget that.
Yeah, how do you, that's great. I mean, I that leads me also to another thought, and it's something that, you know, I speak a lot with friends about. I think probably a lot of us have this in our lives when we, you know, we have a lot of friends and family who are living with HIV. How do you think stigma has changed over the years? Is it something that, I think it personally for me, I find that it represents itself in many different ways in different communities. And I think in many ways we've made extraordinary progress, but in other ways it does feel like it is so often kind of off the table.
Well, you know, it's so tricky, stigma is. It's so sneaky. It moves, it changes, it morphs, you know, it manifests itself in different ways. And, you know, when we talk about HIV, you know, and particularly HIV is a place where stigma manifests itself, you know, on the question of race and gender and sexual orientation and socioeconomic class and disease state. It's all of the, it's kind of the trifecta of kind of oppression and marginalization. And what happens, I think, is that, you know, one group dodges the bullet, and that group doesn't understand, you know, that they are still vulnerable to stigma, and then they become complicit in the perpetuation of stigma against other groups. And we see it, you know, so often. You know, I'm just shocked that, you know, you look at a group and, you know, their experience says to you, you should understand this. Now, and one of the ways that human beings kind of process escaping stigma now is to then perpetuate it onto someone else. And that certainly has been, you know, the history of the United States. You know, when you look at immigration, you know, over the years and migration over the years, that often the most stigmatizing group, no, is the group that until yesterday they were the most recent to arrive. You know, and particularly when you look at it from the lens of ethnic groups, that's a very, you know, well documented history. And I think that the real deal is to understand how we are connected. You know, and as Martin Luther King said, you know, the connection of our mutuality. You know, last week at Thanksgiving, I had an interesting experience. I gave up cooking for Thanksgiving a number of years ago. I just don't do it because for years we do a lot of holiday cooking. We do Kwanzaa and we do a Christmas party and we do all of these big Christmas things. I decided to my family, I'm not cooking anymore. And so this year, we were invited, my partner and I were invited to three different Thanksgiving events. The first one was my family Thanksgiving event, and which is a traditional Black Thanksgiving. The extended family is too large for us to sit at a table, so it's kind of a buffet kind of thing. But the way that the dinner starts is the way that Thanksgiving has always started in my experience with my family. So we now stand around, you know, holding hands and doing grace. And what's interesting this year, because, you know, we were in Los Angeles, is that the one person who was in attendance that was not a part of our family, no, was a Mexican American. And what's even more interesting is he did the grace, you know. And so there we are, this very traditional Black family, and no, this Mexican American doing the grace. And so we left there, and we went to, you know, friend's house, who are interracial couples. She's Filipino and he's African American. And there they had No, a very laid-back kind of Thanksgiving where they prepare tons and tons of food, American fare, Filipino fare, and they just put it on a counter, even in the pots and what have you, on the counter. I'm sure people are familiar with this kind of experience. And people just came in. And during the course of the afternoon, folks just flowed in and out and what have you. So that was one Thanksgiving experience. The final Thanksgiving experience that we had, we were invited to sit down dinner for 30 people, hosted by a friend of ours who is a Korean surgeon, and his wife was a Korean minister. And so this was a very eclectic and diverse group where there were African Americans and lots of Koreans and Latino Americans, you know, and the whole group of folks. And again, you know, there were too many people to kind of sit at one table, and we stood around holding hands, saying prayer. You know? And it all came full circle, and it kind of reminded me that the quintessential American holiday is not the 4th of July. The quintessential American holiday is actually Thanksgiving. Now, that is our legacy. Now, that defines who we are. And it is the story of a group of immigrants who were welcomed by people who lived here. Now, and every time we honor that tradition, now, we do the right thing. We're on the right side of history. And when we act against that tradition, because that's truly who we are, we're on the wrong side of history. And so that brings me back to kind of the Syrian conversation we're having. You know, the fact that we are even considering not welcoming Syrian refugees at this particular time, you know, is really a travesty given who we are, who we really are, not just who we're supposed to be, but in my heart, who we really are.
What you're saying really reminds me, there's this wonderful quote in this Italian novel, The Leopard, where one of the protagonists says, the more things change, the more they remain the same. And that really speaks to kind of what you're saying about what we're experiencing today with Syria and its analogies to so many other times, and we have not stepped forward with open arms. And that, you know, that relates to stigma. Let me ask you about race. We've had a lot of, you know, as in every city in this country, we've had a lot of conversations about race in this city. We've had a lot of conversations, and probably not enough, but conversations about how that intersects with our LGBTQ communities. How have you seen, watching Black Lives Matter, how have you seen that movement as a gay man kind of evolve and also being part of the African-American community?
You know, it's interesting. I don't know that I see that movement either through the lens of being a gay man, and in some ways, not even through the lens of being a Black man. You know, I find it heartbreaking and shocking that we can witness what's happening now on our streets all over the country with the regularity that we are witnessing. And there is room to have a debate over whether or not race is an issue in America today. And so, now, this week alone, we have two big stories in the news. Okay, we have the story in Colorado where a guy goes in with a gun into a Planned Parenthood, takes hostages, and kills people, and he gets taken alive. We have a 17-year-old boy in Chicago with a knife 20 feet away from the police officer, and the police officer feels so threatened that he ends up dead. How is this not about race? Now, how is this not about race? You know, I just don't get it. You know, and the problem about that that is also kind of mind-boggling for me is that somehow we can have a conversation where we don't get, no matter who you are, that it is about us. You know, and I said earlier that justice cannot mean just us, no matter who the us is. Now, that these issues impact all of us, whether we live in Chicago or Seattle or Los Angeles or St. Louis or wherever, they are about all of us because they're a commentary on what kind of America we want to live in.
I agree. So as we all wrestle with this in different ways and talk about it, try to talk about it more in our communities, are there lessons that you've taken from the years of activism where you've been leading so many efforts and movements at different times, at different points and struggles? Are there lessons when you look historically that you sort of think, you know, wow, this was a lot like that moment?
Right, right, right. Well, you know, earlier I mentioned that I'm going to be 60 in April, and which means that I was born in 1956, and it's kind of an interesting period in time. Now, from the see the movement that's happened in this country from 1956 now to 2015, now a span of time where we literally went from sanctioned segregation, racial segregation in this country, through issues around gender and LGBT equality, to now marriage equality in this country. That's a huge amount of distance to go in a lifetime. And what has been interesting is that every movement that I've been involved in, starting with the traditional civil rights movement, entering into the LGBTQ movement, or eventually Q movement, to HIV and AIDS. Now, all of them have really just been the same movement. Now, names have been changed, but the same movement. Now, all of them have been the same thing, and they all have been about, folks having the space to be. Now, and our ability to connect with each other and our ability to want the best for each other. And quite frankly, the tactics have been the same. And I think that in the LGBT context, where it is so profound, there has been no social justice movement in the history of this country that has moved, quite frankly, as fast as marriage equality. And it happened, quite frankly, on the backs of the AIDS movement. Now, literally, the infrastructure that was used to create marriage equality was the infrastructure that was built out of the HIV-AIDS movement and on the lives of people who were living, who were dying from HIV. And that movement came out of an earlier LGBT movement that grew out of the peace movement, that grew out of the Black Civil Rights Movement. And all of it was about, getting to know us. Now, the civil rights movement would not have happened if it weren't for the nascent TV industry. The fact that television brought that battle into people's lives. Now, the AIDS movement wouldn't have happened if it weren't for, in many parts, because of ACT UP, who introduced people who were literally living with HIV and AIDS. And the marriage equality movement wouldn't happen if it weren't for the fact that eventually almost every American knew somebody that this touched. And so all of it was about familiarity. And so we make these social movements to the degree that we can tell our neighbors that our aspirations and our dreams, even if the way we go about them, are the same as yours. Not that we have to be you, not that we have to be the same as you, but our aspirations around life and liberty and joy and happiness are the same. And it's that connection that kind of moves people forward. And it only happens if people know us. And so in the LGBT movement, where early on, well, not so early on, I guess, where we made a commitment to come out. Now, and I remember sitting actually in the room where we created National Coming Out Day. And there are people who didn't think it was a good idea. And there are people who thought, we cannot live without them knowing us. And they can't love us if they don't know us. And the only way forward is for us to introduce ourselves to them. And that proved to be so true, and that also has been a message that has been useful since then, both in LGBT issues and certainly in HIV and AIDS.
So I'm going to ask you one more question and then turn it over to the audience. So you've here in Washington State, we've had an effort set to end HIV in Washington right. State by a certain date in the future, right? You've been involved in so many, the founding of groups like the AIDS Healthcare Foundation. You've seen this conversation play out at the presidential level with the President's Task Force on HIV and AIDS. You've seen this in a lot of places and different levels of government and local, national, international. What worries you? I mean, what's kind of the, you probably get asked this, but what really concerns you, or what are we missing when we set these targets that are ambitious about ending AIDS?
Ending AIDS for whom? Now, who gets left behind? Part of the challenge that we're dealing with right now, quite frankly, is that there's the mistake that thinking that some very effective therapies that work for some of the people some of the time makes a cure, makes a remedy, and it doesn't. Now, and if we want to end the AIDS epidemic, a part of that has to be making sure that it is about everybody. It is about the folks who aren't in the room. It is about the folks who don't look like us. It's about the folks that we don't think about. It is being worried about what we've not thought about. And now, in all of these efforts, which I applaud, I've been a part of a lot of them, I think it's remarkable and fantastic that there's a commitment to end the AIDS epidemic in Seattle and in the state of Washington. My dream and my nightmare is that commitment will manifest itself by ending the AIDS epidemic among quote unquote, those who count, as opposed to all of us.
Thank you. Yeah, with that, let's turn it over to the audience. We can take a handful of questions.
I think that if we're serious about ending the AIDS epidemic in the state, there are a whole bunch of policy issues that have to be addressed straight on. Number one, we need to embrace and understand the paradigm that we're going to actually end the AIDS epidemic. We're going to end the AIDS epidemic because we stop transmissions. We're going to end the AIDS epidemic because we stop acquisition. Okay, you can't stop transmission and acquisition if you are not fully on board for HIV testing. Now, central to getting there is that people need to know their HIV status, and they need to know it on an ongoing basis. And so from a public health perspective, we need to maximize our efforts to facilitate and encourage people to take an HIV test. And in states and in jurisdictions where it's mandatory to offer the test, now, it's not necessarily mandatory that you have to take the test. I don't think that that's a good strategy. But it should be mandatory that you offer the test, and people have to decide that they don't want to take it. Opt-out, I think, is the most progressive, the most public health sound strategy around HIV testing that will get us to the end of the AIDS epidemic. The second policy is really how do you encourage people to come to the game? And criminalization is a huge barrier that will undermine all of our efforts to end the AIDS epidemic as long as we continue to criminalize now HIV in a discriminatory way. We talked about stigma earlier, and criminalization is really about punishing vulnerable people. Now, and in the case of HIV and AIDS in 2015, in an irrational way. Now, because if you really sit down and you think about it, who's most vulnerable now to be the to be penalized now for living with HIV? It's someone who knows their HIV status. You can't go to jail if you don't know your HIV status. Now, there's someone who there's evidence that they are HIV positive, like being on meds. You know, and these are all things that we want people to do. Now, folks who are vulnerable because they're trying to protect themselves, like young women and particularly trans women who can be arrested because they have condoms in their purses, because that's evidence of prostitution. Now, how crazy is that? So I think that any state that's talking about ending the AIDS epidemic has to kind of reconcile these policy challenges, you know, has to deal with how do you increase the number of people who know their HIV status, and how do you create an environment that encourages them to do that? How do you incentivize people to get tested and to seek treatment and to stay in treatment, and you don't do that by making them criminals. You don't do that by increasing the marginalization, and you don't do that in the face that science that tells you that you should behave otherwise.
Yeah, please.
Well, AIDS is considered an epidemic today by, quite frankly, the measure in which we define an epidemic, that we have continuing new infections, even though we're doing a much better job. The truth of the matter is, even with PrEP, even with treatment as prevention, the number of new infections in this country hasn't gone down in 20 years. We're roughly between 40 and 50,000 new infections every year. In addition to that, we've made advances in people living with HIV, so we have a larger population of people who are living with HIV. We have fewer deaths, but we still have an epidemic because we have continuing new infections. And you can't end an epidemic until you solve that major fundamental challenge. But the fundamental issue around an epidemic is really tied to two phenomena. One is prevalence and one is incidence. Now, prevalence is the number of people who are living with the disease at incidence at a given time, and incidence is the number of new infections. In the United States and actually across the world, we still have an epidemic because we still have ongoing incidence and rising prevalence.
Great. Are there any questions?
Well, the issue around rising STIs is something that we need to take really, really seriously. What I don't see and what I don't believe is that the rising STIs is, A, inextricably connected to the opportunity for people to be on pre-exposure prophylaxis. Fundamentally, the uptake on PrEP hasn't been great enough yet for that to be the driving force on the rising cases of STIs. And in fact, when you look at the communities where we've seen the steepest rise in HIV and STIs, that increase happened long before the FDA approved Truvada for PrEP, number one. And number two, the biggest rises are in communities that are not uptaking PrEP at all. So I think we have to unpack that. I think that if we're going to look at STIs, what we need to look at is the fact that we have been completely irresponsible from a public health perspective to even address STIs to begin with. Now, in all populations.
What communities are we seeing those highest rises in?
Well, particularly in minority communities, among heterosexual men, and heterosexual black men, for example, we've been seeing rising STIs in those populations for a long time. We've been seeing rising STIs among young men who have sex with men as well. So all these various communities. And part of that is that, we don't approach sexual health in a comprehensive manner. We have one conversation about HIV. We have another completely underfunded conversation about STIs. We have another conversation about hepatitis. We have, in another bucket, we have conversations about reproductive health. And what we need to talk about is all of it together. I think that the STI epidemic is going to potentially get worse. Now, in some ways, with numbers, some of that is going to be, quite frankly, the result of increased testing associated with people being on PrEP. Now, when people are being tested for HIV every quarter, we're going to catch more STIs. On the flip side of that, or in a good way, the other thing that's going to happen as more and more people uptake on PrEP, we're going to actually treat STIs earlier. You know, in the current environment, people will get an STI and not know for 6 months or a year or 2 years they even have STIs and how many infections happen in that period of time. In an environment where people actually are seeing a doctor and doing labs on a quarterly basis, that's going to be an opportunity for us to diagnose quicker and treat quicker. So PrEP, in fact, might be a way to address STIs. The other factor is we really need to have comprehensive conversations around what PrEP is and what it isn't. You know, and so PrEP will protect you from HIV. It's not going to protect you from gonorrhea, syphilis, or chlamydia. That doesn't mean you should use it to protect you from HIV. A seatbelt will protect you from a car crash, but it's not going to protect you from lightning. Doesn't mean you don't use seatbelts. You know, it means that you need to use different strategies to protect you from different things.
Yeah, please, George.
Okay. I think you got back to your first question. I think I can answer the first question. I was a little worried there that there was going to be too many questions and I was going to ask it. But I think the fundamental question is, you know, what do we need to talk about if we really want to successfully have an uptake in PrEP as a prevention tool? I reiterate, a prevention tool. It doesn't mean you have to throw out any of the other tools we already have. So I think there are five things. Number one, we have to kind of get rid of this moral conversation that we're having and this morality associated with PrEP, which is really kind of crazy. Now, so my question is, if there can be Truvada whores, why aren't there condom whores? I mean, basically, isn't the reason why you use a condom is the same reason why you want to use PrEP? Now, and quite frankly, for those of us who read, if you read the outside of a condom, it actually says, it has a word on it that says prophylaxis, and so a condom is a pre-exposure prophylaxis. Now, and Truvada is a pre-exposure prophylaxis. They're both prophylaxis. Now, so kind of dealing with the stigma and kind of the moral judgment around that. Number two, is educating, folks around what it is, not just folks who are likely to be candidates to take it, but primarily folks who are working in the field, clinicians and doctors and folks who are working in HIV. The next thing is about really access, and making sure that we deal with the three barriers of access. One is the cost of the drugs. Second is the cost of the labs. Third, is the cost of the doctor's visits. So to make sure that we are dealing with that. Now, and then finally, is to address the larger barriers. Now, at the Black AIDS Institute, we get calls every day with someone who is in panic around HIV, often folks who just found out their HIV status. And the tragedy is that they either didn't know how to protect themselves or they didn't know that their lives were worth protecting. And often they're in places where they, in fact, could have access to care. And so we haven't dealt with the reasons why people are motivated to take care of their lives. If I don't think that my life is worth it, then I'm not going to protect myself either by using a condom or by going on PrEP or any of those, or even adhering to treatments. And so dealing with those kinds of issues are critically important. And the final thing is the thing I said earlier, and that is having conversations about what PrEP is and what it isn't. Now, all of that becomes the package the package that we have to kind of look at if we want to be successful and effective in delivering a PrEP message. Inclusive, quite frankly, different messages for different folks. Now, the messenger matters, the conversation that you need to have now among young black men who have sex with men is probably very different than the conversation you're going to have with older white gay men, which is different from the conversation you're going to have with black women or the conversation you're going to have with trans women. Now, we all come to this with a different need. And part of that also should include the fact that PrEP, just because, in the same way that our sexual lives have a season, and that season may be reoccurring, but nevertheless, there are seasons in which we are sexually active. And the way that one is going to ultimately use PrEP is going to coincide with those seasons of your sexual activity. No, if I agree that there's not a focus on a cure, I think that there's a robust and aggressive effort to look at a cure, and a lot of it, quite frankly, is centered here in Seattle. I think comparatively so, you're absolutely right, that I think there's a greater effort, emphasis on PrEP and treatment as prevention than there is on a cure or a vaccine at the moment. We've been disappointed in the success we've had around vaccines for a long time. I think that the balance is really tied to kind of creating the proper balance around short-term, medium-term, and long-term goals and objectives. I live in Los Angeles. I live in a fire zone. We have fires all the time. And when there's a fire, the first thing that you do is you triage the houses. You evacuate the houses that's closest to the fire. You deal with that immediate threat. Now, often you also then do other work further down the fire line as well. But the first response is to that place closest to the fire. And I think that right now, every single day, as we know, there are people who are getting infected with HIV. And we have a responsibility to kind of stop that hemorrhaging while we continue to work on a cure and we work on a vaccine. So I don't necessarily know that the balance is quite right at the moment. I actually don't know what the proper balance should be. I'm just not smart enough to kind of figure that out. But I don't believe that we're not paying attention to a cure. And I understand why we're paying more attention to treatment as prevention and to the PrEP. Because the truth of the matter is that we could do a huge amount to dramatically slow down the epidemic if we're successful there. And we're not yet successful on utilizing either of those tools, and particularly on the treatment as prevention part. Today we're having a lot of conversation around treatment as prevention, but let's not forget that treatment is treatment. We now know that HIV is an inflammatory disease. We now know there's no latency period at all. That's a myth, and that HIV begins to do damage at the point in which you're infected. And so we should not be waiting for people to go on treatment, and that while a byproduct of people on treatment is treatment as prevention, the main reason why we want people on treatment is because treatment is certainly treatment. Now, there's no debating about that. And people live longer, healthier lives, and we owe it to people living with HIV to create an environment, as the president says, and as the vision of the National AIDS Strategy said, that new infections are rare, but when they do occur, that people have unfettered access to life-saving treatments, regardless of who they are, where they are, and what they do.
So let's take one more question.
I think that one of the things that's been a cornerstone of the HIV/AIDS movement has been sharing information. And people shouldn't have to reinvent the wheel. And if you learn something in one place, you have an obligation to share that learning with other places. And I think that, that's one way to do it. I think that the other thing is to always be mindful that we are involved in a national discussion. that this federation, this experiment that is the United States of America, that we can influence national policy, and those national policies can have a positive impact in regions of the country where we don't necessarily live, and being ever vigilant about that. And knowing that just because you're having success in your community, that is not good enough. Now, about 25 years ago now, at AIDS Project Los Angeles, we launched a campaign that said, until there's a cure, that we weren't going to stop until there's a cure. And we have an obligation to live up to that pledge, to live up to that commitment, that we weren't going to stop until there's a cure. And that means everywhere.
So let's take one more from, we may do two more. We'll take one from the fellow in the red sweater.
Now they're going.
So let's say I'm someone who doesn't work in HIV, and I'm listening to this podcast, and I decide, World AIDS Day, maybe I should do something, but I have no clue what to do. What would you say to those people?
No matter who you are, no matter where you are, there is certainly some role for you to play in fighting HIV. The easiest and the simplest and probably the most obligatory thing that you should do is to know your own HIV status and to make sure the people that you love know their HIV status. That is the most powerful thing that any of us and all of us can do. And it doesn't matter who you are or where you are. You know, we have a slogan that we stole from another movement, obviously, that we say that friends don't let friends not know their own HIV status. And so I think that's something that whoever's listening to this podcast can do. And in Seattle, for example, you know, an HIV test is free, it's easy, it's simple, it's painless, it's quick. And so there's no reason not to know your own HIV status. And, you know, if you discover that you're HIV positive, it's better to know earlier rather than later, because there's something you can do. Now, HIV doesn't have to be an automatic death sentence. In fact, no, it can be a death sentence if you don't know and if you don't do anything about it. Well, first of all, I think that people are concerned about the stigma associated with HIV, and getting an HIV test today still can be completely confidential. You can take an HIV test in the privacy of your home, and no one needs to know that you're HIV positive. And so disclosure, and there are lots of protections around people's HIV status. You need to disclose your HIV status if you're sexually intimate with someone, but finding out your HIV status can be done in complete privacy and confidentiality. No, I think that the fact that the safety net is being tattered all across this country, not just in HIV, but in all areas, is something that we should be concerned about. I think that as we talk about ending the AIDS epidemic, and there's even debate around that. So what does an AIDS-free generation mean for those of us who are living with HIV? Where are we going in this AIDS-free generation or world without AIDS? What is our role in that world? And the reason why that language is important, because there are a lot of folks who need services, and here in Seattle, for example, that's why organizations like Gay Cities are important, because those wraparound services will continue to be important, particularly with the graying of AIDS in America, that we all have those issues associated with getting older. There are particular issues with having an inflammatory disease, for decades, that are a problem. And so as we continue to do this work, there really has to be a constant drumbeat around services for people who are living with HIV now and people who are living with AIDS, and we should not lose sight of that as we move forward. And I think that key to that is paying attention to the institutions in our communities that provide those services.
So let me just thank Phil. Let's give him a resounding round of applause for joining us. I think that was very enlightening, motivational, and I especially appreciate the call to action to both know our own statuses and to have it incumbent upon us to also encourage our friends to know theirs. So I think that's a great message on World AIDS Day as we, you know, go forth from the Seattle Public Library. So thanks for hosting us here.
Thank you.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.